This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com, where you can also check out past editions of the program. We have a very relevant guest today. Every time we get around to August, at least the first week of August, try to turn our attention back to something that happened in that week back in 1945, on August the 6th of 1945, to be exact. And to kind of set the stage for our conversation today with 85-year-old Mo Rana, I want you to listen to what the President of the United States had to say shortly thereafter, back in August of 1945. Here's Harry Truman.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
So that was President Harry Truman in August of 1945. This week we will mark that anniversary. Of course, if you do the math for that, this will be the 64th anniversary of the first time that nuclear weapons had ever been deployed in war, dropped on Hiroshima by Colonel Paul Tibbetts and the Enola Gay on August 6, 1945. Our guest today has a very unique connection to those events. I want to welcome in one of the few, the proud, the U.S. Marine Corps veterans of the Central Valley, Mo Rana, 85 years old. And Mo, I've already heard you do this, so I'm going to let our listeners here. Why don't you greet us with a hearty hoo-ah?
Hoo-ah!
Only a Marine could say it like that. He's got his Semper Fi hat on. Very proud to be a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. And he has a very unique story to tell. We're going to hear about maybe some boxing matches along the way, his connection to that first atomic bomb in world history, and the other experiences that he had in the Pacific during World War II. Let's start at the beginning, Mo. I know you grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. We might pick up a little bit of that accent by the time this program's over. But how did you end up in the Marine Corps? When the war started, is that something that you envisioned yourself doing?
No, I always wanted to be a Marine. So when the war started, I went along to all my classes in high school and see how I was standing in my courses. And this is about 4 months ahead of graduation. I wanted that diploma in the worst way before I did anything in life. And they said, yep, you're okay. They okayed me to join the Marine Corps. And so I went down the following day and joined the U.S. Marines.
So was that before Pearl Harbor happened?
No, that was after Pearl Harbor.
I imagine Pearl Harbor maybe strengthened your determination a little bit to become a Marine.
Oh, yes.
What do you remember about that day, December 7th, 1941?
What I remember that day, we were a bunch of us coming home from a picnic ground. There were about five or six of us, all boys. And we happened to go to a movie that night. And in between the interruption in the movie, that's when they came by and said that Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese. And all military men to report to their outfits. And I was only 16 years old then, but I felt it in my blood that I had to do something about getting into it too, because we all did, no matter who it was. And from that point on, I just had one ambition in my mind then, is to get my high school diploma. Because out of a family of five, two sisters and three brothers, I was the only one in the family. Because of the Depression, I was the only one in the family to get a high school diploma. Mm. And that made my parents pretty proud. And I wanted that. And as soon as I knew that I had succeeded in getting my diploma, I joined the Marine Corps.
Now, I talked to a lot of veterans, particularly in the Marine Corps, who had this idea before they got into the Marines of what it was going to be like. And obviously there's an image of what a Marine is and what it takes to become a Marine. Did you find that things were a little tougher than you expected them to be as far as boot camp and the training that you needed to become a Marine, or was it exactly what you thought it was going to be?
You got to realize, in the era that we were brought up, the Depression time, everything was tough.
Mm-hmm.
We were kids that were brought up tough. Not that, I mean, we were bad boys. We were learned a tough life. And when I did get to boot camp, it was tough in the boot camp, but we did it. Everyone got used to the orders and the discipline, just like clockwork. And everyone in that battalion of mine were all brought up that way. So there were no Minnie Mouse or Mommy Dear kids in the outfit. We're all brought up to the, well, how would I say? We all had to make a living, and we were living in that era then, that everyone was for the family. And
you didn't expect anything to be handed to you?
No, never.
Now, I've read a lot about the Marine Corps in those days, and boy, in the Pacific, there were some horrible circumstances that Marines ended up in, from Tarawa to Peleliu. Mm-hmm. The guys who got stuck on Pavuvu for a while sounded like that was worse than anything the enemy could throw at them. But one thing that really intrigues me was this idea of the old breed, the Marines that had been in before the war started. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there was a lot of mentoring there, or maybe that those guys, if you weren't tough enough already, they were going to make darn sure that you were tough by the time you got through.
Myself and more of the recruits, we did look up at the old-timers of this. We only had 6 divisions in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that were, I think it was the 6th Division that was in China, we looked up to those people because they all knew what war was all about, and they kind of talked to us about what to expect and what not to do and what to do. And we listened, because a lot of the stuff that they gave us was meant for our own salvation, saved most of our lives. So they were really tutors, the old-timers, and we stuck by them all the time.
Do you ever look back now, and particularly if you look at the casualty rates from some of the really intense battles, Iwo Jima or Okinawa or some of those that I've already mentioned, do you ever look back and pinch yourself and say, how am I still here? How did I survive all of this? Why wasn't I one of those guys at one of those places?
You know, that is a question. That's an answer to that is, the first time you ever hit a beach, you get on that beach and you're digging in, and you're scared. When we hit that beach, we were all in a situation where we needed a toilet, let's say.
Uh-huh. Or a new pair of pants.
And digging in. But after that, I can truthfully say, as we're charging in, we never thought of getting hit or where the next bullet was going to come from or if we were going to get hit. We was on the go, go, go. If we got hit, we got hit. But we never thought about it. I never thought about it, and none of us did. It just doesn't work that way. At the initial landing, it does. You don't want to do anything. But after you get going, the adrenaline gets into your blood, and you just go on and on and on. And if it happens that you get hit, you get hit.
Well, and I imagine for you, you're what, 6 feet, 2 inches tall? You're a bigger target than a lot of your Marine Corps buddies.
I was.
That probably doesn't make you feel too good.
Well, we were in good shape.
You mentioned the first time you hit the beach, so I want to talk about that. And maybe before we get to that, when you finally got word you're heading overseas, what did that do to you psychologically? And what do you think was on your mind as you left the United States? I'm sure you had no idea where you were going, but you knew you were going somewhere where it wasn't going to be fun and games. What do you remember about that time, and what kinds of thoughts were going through your head as you headed off to war?
Well, as soon as we left the United States to go hit the islands, I can't say I was sorry. I said, good, we're finally getting into the war.
You had been antsy, ready to go.
Oh, yeah, after our boot camp, anything would have been easier than that. Because we had a pretty rugged boot camp training in Parris Island, North Carolina, or South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the only thought that came to my mind. We're ready to go. All of us felt the same way. About time we're getting to get into this war. We were all ready to get in there.
Did you feel like that made you closer with the guys serving around you, the fact that you had been through something so tough together?
Very close. Very close. Even today, Marines usually stick together. No matter where you might be from another part of the country. But if you find out he's a Semper Fi man, right away there's camaraderie there.
Well, and it's hard to miss with you today. You've got your Marine Corps League of Fresno shirt on, your U.S. Marine Corps hat on, and I know you've got a sticker on your truck, too. And I think the Marines are as proud of you as you are to be one. I'll tell you what, we're going to take our first break right here. But when we come back, we're going to hear about that first time that Mo Rana hit the beach and some more of his war experience, including his connection to that first atomic bomb and really both bombs in August of 1945. I don't think you're going to guess this one, but he'll answer it for us when we get there. This is Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. U.S. Marine Corps theme played there by the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local band who you hear me talk about, hear me play their music quite frequently, and I'm sure you'll be seeing them somewhere soon and hopefully listening to them as well. I'm looking forward to KMJ's Lifestyle Expo coming up on August 29th at the Radisson Convention Center in downtown Fresno. One of the seminars I'll be taking part in is one on preserving family history, and I'd love to see you down there on August the 29th. You'll be hearing more information coming up soon about that day. But for this day, let's continue with Marine Corps veteran Mo Rana, 85 years old and still as sharp as can be. You can feel it in his handshake, and I know you can hear it coming over the airwaves with a little bit of a Worcester, Massachusetts accent that still remains all these years later. Mo, we talked about your early recollections of your time in the Marine Corps, and you made reference to that first time you hit the beach. For you, the first time you hit the beach was at the island of Tinian.
Tinian.
What do you remember about that? And did you sense the night before you went in that there was some anticipation in the air? Was everybody getting a little antsy, waiting to go, or what was that like?
The anticipation of getting there is always there, because as soon as you get into the LSD, that means you're going to die. You're going to hit the beach.
You can't stop halfway through and jump off.
You can't. I mean, there's a feeling in you. Really, I'll take my own account. I didn't think about anything. I said my rosary, my prayer, and that's it. Ready to go. Mm-hmm. And hoping that everything would be all right.
You know, you, not to sidetrack too much here, you mentioned your family and how mm-hmm. you were the first in your family to get a high school education. You had a large Italian family. How did your mother feel about you being in the Marine Corps? What did your family think about what you were doing over there?
Well, they were Italian immigrants, and my mother was the only one that couldn't speak English. My father did. And just coming home and telling her that I was going away to war, well, naturally, she just cried, and she didn't want any of her sons to go. But there were three of us, and we all went, two of them in the Army and me in the Marine Corps. And for her feelings, you could see her feelings were there, and her crying and everything, but that's as emotional as we got. Then I had to leave, which was good, because boom, the next morning I walked over to the, all by myself about 4 o'clock in the morning, to the railroad station and got on the railroad station, the train to Parris Island. But it was a feeling that I can't describe it to you, really. We didn't, you know, some things you can anticipate that you're going into something. Others, you're going to war. You're going to fight. The Japanese was on all our minds. We got to go fight. We got to defend our country. That's all that was in our mind. Mm-hmm. That's it.
So here you are at Tinian, and you say you get on that LST. You know where it's going. It's going to a beach, but this is not a fun in the sun kind of day. You know exactly where you're going and what you're going to do there. When they actually lowered the door or let you off of that, What do you recall seeing? What was that experience like? Was there more opposition than you thought there would be? Was there less? Did it surprise you?
Well, let's get this. Before the Marianas were even one man touched their shores, We had an armada out there, the greatest, the biggest in the world. You've never seen battleships, cruisers, bombarding those islands for about a week at a time.
That's
night
right.
and day, night and day. And then so by the time they gave us the word that we were going to, I was on a special duty roster where I was in charge of a radar unit that was one of the first ever put into the Pacific. So I had equipment and men to worry about in my landing. So as soon as we hit the beach, we didn't get any opposition.
And you expected it.
And we expected it. But further on in, then we got the opposition. And the caves were full of Japs. We never could dent the caves. That's what gave us the biggest worry.
And you had, correct me if I'm wrong, but you, as the soldiers going in on the ground, you had no idea that they had these vast tunnel systems built on these islands.
We thought the way they were pulverizing those islands, we said nothing could live on those islands.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's 15, 20,000 Japs waiting for us.
Mm-hmm.
See, they were all hidden in caves. And that planning must have been years and years and years in advance of what was going to happen.
It's pretty remarkable when you start to study some of those locations and how intricate the preparations were. You walked in kind of blind to that, but tell me a little bit more about your duties. You mentioned the radar situation a moment ago. Now, you were with
the 17th AA.
And that's anti-aircraft artillery?
Battalion.
Uh-huh.
Battalion. And we were set up with radar units and 90-millimeter guns. And we fortified the whole island.
So the radar was just to detect incoming Japanese aircraft?
Incoming Japanese aircraft. They were coming in. As soon as the B-29s landed on Tinian, then we used to get air raids every night from Japan. And the radars, we'd catch them about 15,000 yards out and then give command to our 90 millimeters, like myself. Let's say I was on the scope. And as soon as I locked in on the lead Japanese plane, I'd call to the battalion and says, give them the coordinates, everything. And then I said, lock in. And what they do is they 90 millimeters would lock in with my radar.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, I was in control of the whole thing. And then as soon as they come in about 10,000 yards, then they'd start firing. And we blew out a lot of them out of the sky. A lot of them got in and done quite a bit of damage. But that was our main defense was the radar unit and how to accomplish what we had to do.
Well, I want to, just in the big picture here, obviously the key significance of Tinian in the whole war was its role that it eventually played in August of 1945 and before, but to be a runway and a place where these big bombers could land and take off. You mentioned the B-29s. Go ahead.
Tinian was one of the airstrips.
Yep.
Saipan was one, and then Guam.
Guam was a huge
one. Stepping stones.
And
all of them had
B-29. Yep.
Iwo Jima was a war, fighting. Mm-hmm. But these three strips, three islands were aircraft strips for us, for the B-29s to come in and land. Now, with a B-29, they could make the trip from Tinian to Saipan and Guam to Japan and back on one tank full of gas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we needed these islands. Then Okinawa came next, and then from Okinawa we took Iwo Jima. It was all planned that way.
And your role with this radar station was crucial because you're trying to protect all these B-29s that are on the runway there and make sure the Japanese don't destroy them. But I think everybody at home is probably asking the same question that comes to my mind. When you're sitting there looking at this radar detection system, which I'm sure is still fairly new to you, it's not something that you grew up playing with in Worcester.
It was new to everybody.
It was brand new.
But I got into the electronics part of it and they figured that was my MO, and that's where I ended up.
Well, it just occurs to me that when you're looking at this, there's a great possibility that you could see something that isn't really what it appears to be. How do you differentiate between a Japanese plane coming in and one of your own planes coming in?
Okay. After a while, Japanese got wise to us.
Uh-huh.
And so what their lead plane would do, it's all on, you're going to see it on film.
All right.
It's all on the lead plane to come in and drop in this silver foil.
Right.
And as they dropped the silver foil, all our radar scopes would be like nothing there. They look like all kind of pips. When I say a pip, you can determine the pip of a plane and the pip of a foil. But when this stuff was falling, you couldn't figure out anything. And that's when they came in and really done a job on us.
So at that point, you're pretty much blind.
Right, you are. And until we figured out how to overcome that, and then they couldn't come in anymore. But that's how they followed us up at the beginning.
So how could you overcome that? You just set me up for that question. What did you do in response to their
foil? Had operators on all the battalions, or let's see, 1, 2, 3. They were, what would I say? They were kind of unique. When they got on the scope to pick out the pip de law, the first Japanese plane before the
before they dropped the foil.
Before they dropped the foil. And he'd lock it on it and keep on it until he come all the way in almost to the island. And that way, the only way we could detect the planes coming in was that way. That didn't confuse the operator that was on the scope.
So if you knew where the lead plane was going, you knew where the rest of them were going.
Right.
Gotcha. Well, the foil was eventually foiled,
yeah,
it sounds like,
it was.
With what you guys
and
were doing.
And then we had another thing, information, friend or foe,
right,
on all the planes.
IFF.
If that didn't show up on the BIP, you knew it was an enemy.
Well, you thought it was an enemy. Because I've talked to plenty of pilots who thought that the guys on the ground should have known who they were because of IFF, but then they got shot at anyway.
No, there's a lot of quirky things that happen.
Was that ever a fear of yours? That friendly fire would occur, and that something that you called out to the artillery could possibly shoot down one of your own guys?
Never.
You were that confident in the system?
Yeah.
And if it happens, I guess there's nothing you can do about it.
No, there isn't.
Well, I think it's another good stopping point here with Mo Rana, so we'll catch a quick breather and then come back with some more of his experiences in the Pacific during World War II. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am, and I'm not going to let him take a swing at me, but I want to get to the bottom of some of these boxing tales from the war, and also about the big boxes on the USS Indianapolis that were unloaded on the island of Tinian, and Mo had a big hand in that. So we're going to get to that when we come back. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're with you every Saturday online at kmjnow.com and, of course, on the mammoth gargantuan signal that is News Talk 580 KMJ. It's a pleasure visiting today with Mo Rana, a very timely guest because of his connection to what happened in the Pacific in early August of 1945. This coming week on August 6th will mark the 64th anniversary of the first time an atomic weapon was ever used in war in world history. That, of course, was the bomb dropped on Hiroshima by the Enola Gay, piloted by Paul Tibbets, and a guy who played a little ball with Paul,
yes,
Tibbets on the island of Tinian. Mo Rana is my guest today. Now, playing ball, playing softball, boxing, sounds like you guys were goofing off a lot over there with the Marine Corps in the Pacific. But I guess that was a pretty small part of what you're actually doing.
You might say that was an hour.
Absolutely.
Because after we took the island and the B-29s were coming in and the security was secured for the island with our radar and everything, we had a lot of time on our hands. And what would happen is the pilots from Saipan, the B-29 pilots from Saipan, would fly over to Tinian and we'd play ball with them,
mm-hmm,
baseball. They'd come in with a team and we'd have a team and somebody beat somebody and then they'd leave because they had a mission to go to at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the heartbreak of this was, if I played ball with you today, the next day when you expect them to come back to play again, then we got the word from their comrades that they were shot down over Japan.
Mm.
We never seen them again. That was the real thing that we had to look forward to. Are we going to see you again? But at the same time, we were enjoying ourselves with them. Everybody wasn't thinking about the war. We were playing ball and everything. But we knew what we had to do, and it was kind of bad.
Well, and along those lines, you mentioned earlier how tight you become when you're in these tough situations, mm-hmm, together, particularly in the Marine Corps. You take the island of Tinian, and you remain there because of the importance of your duties with, mm-hmm, that radar station, with the 17th AA. A lot of the other Marines that took that island move on to other islands. Iwo Jima was one of them, and Okinawa.
Okinawa was first, and then Iwo Jima.
And those two islands claimed thousands and thousands of American lives. How, I imagine you had to lose dozens of friends.
Almost all of them, because on Okinawa, they almost all got wiped out. And the only way we got that news is through radio broadcasts that come out early in the morning from San Francisco. Mm. That's how we got our war news. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known anything about that. And then Iwo Jima was, they didn't come from our outfit. There was a 3rd Marine Division under the 1st. They hit Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
But
you stayed behind on Tinian because of the work to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got later and later in 1945, you find out that the USS Indianapolis is delivering a certain cargo. Yeah. Now, did you have any idea what was going on?
Let me tell you about that.
I want to hear it.
We as Marines on an island, we didn't have any food. We had little C rations, a little can of beans for our meals. No K rations, no anything like that. And every now and then when the Army start coming into the island, they stopped bringing up the food, like K-rations and peaches and the fruit and all that stuff. But we weren't getting any of it. Mm. So the word would come out that a ship was coming in with some food, and they needed a couple of trucks from our outfit to go help unload these ships to bring the food to the Army dump. So we volunteered.
I could see why.
We were always the last two trucks in the train. They're probably about 25, 30 trucks.
Uh-huh.
We were always the last two trucks. And so when our trucks come in time for the derricks to come down with the food, the word would get to us down in the hole, our trucks are here. Okay. Everything that went on those two trucks was ours.
Mm-hmm.
So as they're taken off from the pier, and it's hilly territory, you see this train. You visualize this caravan of trucks going straight and round and round. And at one point, two trucks go another way. And they went to our battalion headquarters. We used to steal a lot of food like that. So.
And something tells me that there was some food consumed on the drive from the pier to your
battalion
headquarters.
Oh, and in the hole, we used to break open those cases like mad and eat the peaches and pears. Oh, we had a hell of a time until we... We loaded up our own two trucks. And the word come in one day to the Marine Corps headquarters that we need two trucks, two work units to go down to the Indianapolis to unload a ship. They called on the Marines to do this because the Army was there, but they didn't fool around with the Army. So when we went down to the docks, we figured everybody volunteered on those trips. Because, hey, we're going to eat.
You're going to get some food. Yeah.
When we went down the box, you've never seen so much brass in your life. We've seen colonels, generals, majors, all over the place. Mm-hmm. Security was top. And we'd all look at each other. What the hell gives here? You know, let's get back in the hole and let's unload the ship. So we got down there in the hole, and all we seen was these big crates. So I says, okay, that's what they wanted loaded. You know, we didn't see any food.
Mm-hmm.
And we unloaded the crates on our trucks, and the trucks went to a certain spot on Tinian where there were dugouts for these two bombs, let's say now. These two crates were two bombs.
And you had no idea what's
nothing,
in the crates?
Not a thing. We didn't know anything about the bombs or anything. We didn't know what we unloaded until the first day when Tibbetts took the B-29 and bombed Hiroshima. And then when they come back, that's the only time we found out that we had unloaded the A-bomb, two A-bombs from the...
And when you saw all the brass, all these bigwigs walking around, did you think maybe there is something special in these crates?
Yeah, well, we gave it a thought.
Mm-hmm.
We gave it a thought. Where the hell's all this brass come from? You know, we made all our own comments, but nobody ever figured we were unloading bombs. We had no food, but all the crates were meant to be what was the pieces of the bomb.
Well, and of course, and you and no one else had any idea what an atomic bomb was. Harry Truman didn't even know it existed till Roosevelt died and he became president.
That's right.
So this was a new thing to everybody. How did you find out that they had dropped the bomb on Hiroshima?
The next morning from out of San Francisco.
You heard it on the radio?
Oh, yeah, on the radio.
Did it click at that point?
Then it could. Then we says, that's what we unloaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it came to us that that's what it was unloaded. Then the other one was sent to August 9th to
Nagasaki.
Major Sweeney was the pilot of, the, of that plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a frightful thing to think about, but it saved a heck of a lot of lives.
Well, we heard at the beginning of this program, President Truman saying in the immediate aftermath of that bombing that this would save thousands and thousands of American lives. I've seen official military estimates from that period that put it at least a million American lives. And I'm sitting here talking to one of them because there's little doubt
we would have gone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because they were already, and boy, to land on Japan would have been a massacre, because you're going to, like anybody trying to land in the United States, you know, enemy, it's going to be murder all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ready to defend. They didn't care, but they didn't, it looked like killing them were meant to nothing. They're all for the emperor,
Did you grasp immediately, or how long did it take for you to realize this could save all of our lives? Because we're probably going over there, and maybe this will bring the war to an end. Or was it not until they signed that surrender that you had that idea?
No, when they signed the surrender. We had that idea before that, but not right then and there. After we heard the news, oh, we saved all these lives. We didn't know they surrendered yet. After they surrendered, then we come to the conclusion of how many of us would have been saved. The whole 6 divisions would go to Japan.
When Tibbetts came back to the island with the Enola Gay, did it seem any different than any other B-29 coming back from any other mission? Did you hear any kind of uproar? Or?
No.
Nothing? Or,
I mean, after he dropped the bomb?
Mm-hmm.
No, we had no contact about that. We wouldn't know how they felt or anything.
You know, we had a guy on the program last year, a great gentleman from Visalia named Norris Jernigan, who was with that bomb group and talked about some of the briefings and how interesting that was. And he described Tibbetts. And there's been a lot of focus on Paul Tibbetts and the burden that he bore for the rest of his life for being that first person to drop that bomb. You said you had played ball with him before?
Yeah, we played ball with him. When they come over, they picked up a team to come over to play with us. And then when they left, the next day we didn't know if we see any of them.
Did he make an impression on you, or the kind of person that he was?
No, we didn't know him. We were just another guy coming over to play ball.
Uh-huh.
No, not at all. We didn't know if he was a pilot or a bombardier or just a worker on one of the B-29s.
Well, I bring that up, and like I said, a lot of the attention has been paid to what he dealt with and his conscience and the big picture for everyone over there was how many lives it saved and not how many lives it took. But what about you? When you realized that you and your fellow Marines had along that path of getting those bombs to the Pacific, had unloaded them from the ship and taken them where they needed to go, did that do anything for you to realize that you played a role in maybe the most significant day in world history?
Well, while we were doing it, nothing.
Well, of course
we didn't know
not.
What we were doing.
Right.
But after we found out, oh, yes, it was a good, big impression on all of us. Jeez, did we do that? You know, really meaning it in a group like we talk about it. It was unbelievable that instead of food, we unloaded a couple of atomic bombs. We didn't know what the hell an atomic bomb was anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, yes, the impression was there.
Well, and you think of, and I'm sure you've spent many a night thinking about this, but it had never been done prior to that in world history.
Nope.
It was done once more that very same week. Hasn't happened since, and we all pray that it never happens again.
I hope not.
So you're one of a very few, a very small number and dwindling number of human beings who had a small hand in that.
Well, out of my outfit, we usually have a reunion every year, and it's all parts of the United States. We never know when the next one's going to be. And our last reunion was in Texarkana, Texas, last year. Only 14 of us showed up.
Mm.
There's probably a lot more, but maybe we're sick or something wrong with
it. It's not that easy to travel.
Quite a few of them died.
Mm-hmm.
But I was trying to get Fresno for this one. Maybe 10 people to show up.
Hey, keep working at it.
Oh, yeah.
Tell you what, we're going to take our last little commercial pause here, and then when we come back, we'll hear about how the end of the war was felt by Mo Rana and his fellow Marines. Maybe a little bit about what he's done since then, his involvement in the Marine Corps League here in Fresno, and why he's so proud to be one of the few, the proud, the U.S. Marine Corps veterans. Mo Rana, our guest today, will be back with the final home stretch of Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I'm going to say it again. You hear me say it a lot. Where does all the time go? This program goes by too quickly and run out of time to listen to some of these great stories that each veteran has. Mo Rana has been no exception today. Marine Corps veteran of World War II. Spent all that time on the island of Tinian and was one of the Marines who unloaded those mysterious crates from the USS Indianapolis. The contents of those crates would change world history forever. The bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945. Now, I want to ask you about another bombing, of more conventional variety, and you were on the other end of it. Mm-hmm. All that time you spent on Tinian, you mentioned your duties with the radar station. A lot of this was done inside of a van.
Right.
You were inside of a van with all this electricity and radar equipment. And I understand one time you got a little bit of a close call. A bomb was a little too close for comfort. Tell me about that.
One night we got raided, and there's one Francis bomber. The Japanese bombers were called the Francis. If you know what a C-47 looks like, it's identical to that. Came in pretty close and dropped a bomb maybe about 60 or 70 feet from our radar van. And that blew the hell out of us in the van because of the concussion. And it was lucky that none of us got killed or injured. But it kind of shook me up for about a week before I was well enough to get back into that van and start operating because of the trauma that had gotten a hold of me. That's the closest I come to that. And another time, while we were walking from mess hall to our tent, two Jap Zeros come down the runway, and they riddled the whole runway. And here I am in the middle of the runway. I'm running, and all of a sudden I says, I better jump. And when I did jump, I jumped into a big puddle of mud, water, and everything right next to a 50 caliber revetment. I got on that 50 caliber and tried to shoot him down, but I didn't do it. But there's an aircraft carrier in the vicinity. They got the two Zeros. They were more or less suicide.
Kamikazes.
That was...
So they were strafing. You're running.
Oh, yeah. They were strafing right down. They were trying to get all the B-29s strafed.
And if I didn't paint the picture enough for my listeners earlier, Mo is a big guy. His hand is bigger than mine. You can still feel that strength in his grip. What size shoe do you wear, Mo?
13.
13 shoe. He's 6 feet, 2 inches tall. So those Zeros were firing at a pretty big target running down there, a muddy target after you landed in the puddle. But you had some fun with the 50 cal trying to shoot him down. Close calls. There's so many of them in each veteran's story. And I guess you took some of your biggest shots in the boxing ring. Now, you guys had USO shows. I know one time you listened to Bob Hope on the radio. He was on Saipan neighboring. Yeah. But you provided some entertainment, too. How did these boxing matches arise?
Well, the boxing matches were like grudge fights. And really, I didn't have a grudge against anybody. But they needed people to get in the ring to have a show for all the men. So they got me one. They got me two bouts. One boy was from Boston, Mass. Church was his name. And the other one was Drowowski, who was from Poughkeepsie, New York. Now, these guys knew their way around the ring. I didn't. I was big enough and everything. I had to wait, but I didn't know anything about boxing. So just a few instructions that somebody gave me. He said, this is the way to handle it. This is the way to handle it. And it seems that Drowowski was my second in the ring when I fought Church, and he was giving some tips on how to take Church. Well, this beautiful Irishman from Boston hit me once, and I saw the stars. I didn't go down, but they sensed something was wrong and they called about, I really get hit. My second bout was with maybe about 15 minutes later. And who do I pick as Tarowski, my second? And I said, son of a gun, how worth. But I gave him a good fight. We had a draw. But that was my boxing experience as far as.
I can only imagine that your mother would have had a few choice Italian words for you if you came home from the war battered and bruised from boxing matches.
I guess so. I wouldn't even mention it. No, I wouldn't even mention it.
Speaking of coming home, when VJ Day occurred, when you heard the war is over, the right side had come out victorious. I've heard a lot of stories about celebrations. Did you stay up all night? Got a little extra supplies? What was that like once word got around Tinian that this is over, the Japanese have surrendered?
Well, for that next day, 2 days later, they did give us an extra ration of beer. Then all of a sudden there was food on the table. So where the hell does food come from? All year long we didn't have any, and all of a sudden you got it. Well, anyway, we enjoyed the celebration of the war being over. Now our only thoughts were getting packed and leaving. That's the only. We wanted to get back home.
How long did you have to wait before you came home?
Let me see. December from August, so let's say September to December, 3 months.
Came home in December of 45.
And I had fallen in love with a little dog on the island. I brought it up from a puppy, and I named it Okinawa, Oki.
All right.
And that dog, I'm telling you, was the best dog you ever want to see. And then when we were departing, getting on our ship, and that dog is at the shore and just looking up at us and said, well, why aren't you taking me? That was the saddest thing I ever did, leaving that dog on the shore. Oh, man. That was bad.
Soon enough, you'd see something else that brightened your eyes.
Right.
Did you sail into New York Harbor, or where did you
No, we sailed to San Diego.
San Diego.
Yeah.
When you got back to the States, and I guess maybe more importantly, when you got home and got to see your family again, what did that mean to you? What did that feel like?
Well, the happiness was short-lived, because when I got home, my mother just looked at me and says, gee whiz, you look so good and healthy looking, you know. In the meantime, I had my oldest brother in the Veterans Hospital. He lost 9 layers of skin in Philadelphia, in the Philippines, and he was in tough shape. And then she looked at me and then my other brother, you know, and then when I went to see my brother Pete, the happiness faded because of this sight that I seen in my brother.
Mm.
So we had a celebration, but it was a sad one on account of Pete, my brother.
I can only imagine how difficult that was and how much it makes you not take anything for granted.
Right.
With how fortunate you've been. And I know we're getting short on time here, but you get back to the States. And if you hadn't made it back from the war, you never would have met your wife out here in California, actually. You've got three sons and two grandkids that never would have been born. And I understand that if it weren't for you and your brother, that the Valley would have had to wait a little longer to eat pizza.
Yeah, 10 years.
Hey, that's a long time. Pizza's good.
Until me and Ed started up their chain in 1960.
But you started the first pizzeria in Fresno.
Yeah.
What was it called?
Italian Kitchen Pizzeria.
Uh-huh.
And we brought in all the Italian food from back east, too, lasagna, raviolis, everything homemade. We cooked, nothing was frozen. Mm-hmm. We did all the cooking, my brother and I.
And I bet it tasted a lot better than what you ate on Tinian.
Oh, hell yeah. A lot better.
Well, Mo, we're short on time, but it's been such a pleasure visiting with you. Thank you for serving our country.
One other quip there. My mother sent me a package from Worcester. She had made sauce with meatballs and bourgeois, which is
I love it.
Stuffed big. Everything came good. Everything was all right when it came. It got to us about 5 months later on Tinian. And the spaghetti, there was one big package. So I picked out one night that they were showing a movie and all my squad, I said, let's go over to the mess hall. Let's heat up some water and let's cook the spaghetti and have a spaghetti feed. So they says, okay. So we went over to the mess hall and we start cooking. Now it come time to put the spaghetti in the water to cook it. All we got out of there were pieces of spaghetti, but rat turds all over the place.
Oh, no.
Now, what do you think happened?
You ate it anyway.
Cook it, and put it on the plate, and we all ate everything.
Yeah, that's a different kind of brajoule, to be sure. And what a way to wrap up the program today.
Oh,
but that illustrates
a little bit of humor.
The sign of the times, for sure. Ramo, as I started to say, thank you so much for serving our country and for sharing some of those stories with us today. I know that you're proud to be a Marine, and I think Marines and the rest of us are very proud of you. Yeah. So thank you very much.
And I want to put in a word for the Marine Corps League here. All you Marines that are listening to this program who have not joined the Marine Corps League in Fresno, please get in contact with me, and I'll get you the right applications to join us. Because from we started off with in 1998 with 38 members of the Marine Corps League. As of today, we have over 200 members.
Fantastic.
So we'd like to have you. We're a unit of our own, and now we have some place to go and that belongs to us.
Perfect. And you know what? I'll put a link on our website with that information as well. And we're out of time, Mo, but how about one last hoo-ah?
Hoo!
There we go. That'll do it. That's our show today. It's Hometown Heroes.
Hoo-ah!
There it is again. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.